Well, that was very rich and beautiful. But before I come back to what you said, I was told to say something about disciplinarity, which you might all be sick to death of by now. But nevertheless, a disciplined person, I do what I'm told. So I'll begin with that first of all. If we want an archetype of transdisciplinarity, it might seem we could do no better than begin with the emergence of gender studies, with gender itself, quintessentially transdisciplinary. Gender has a history, a discursive genealogy, symbolic resonance, social regimentation, political resonance, and, yes, evocative ties to anatomical difference, to biological materiality. Out they march, the humanities, social sciences, biological sciences, all muddled in with law, politics, the diverse, cunningly normalized routines of social exploitation and cultural invalidation, or, as we might say today, rolled in with the disabling, often dangerous affects of gender melancholia, maternal guilt, social punitiveness, personal trauma, and shame. However, interestingly, when, as young feminists, some of us first found our voices in higher education over 35 years ago, we did so very much from within whatever disciplines we were studying. It was the invisibility of women that we registered, wanting at first to be heard and to transform the language and theoretical outlook inside each and every subject area, whether taking issue with the ways in which women and their thoughts and actions were rendered other in philosophy's metaphors of agency and reason, hidden from history, absent from economic accounting, marginalized or demeaned in literary criticism, sidelined or individually mismeasured in sex difference research in psychology, reduced to reproductive ciphers in biology, squeezed into normative and subordinating gender roles in sociological research, and so on. Whatever women were studying, the battle was to reform, to transform disciplinary knowledge itself, usually by stressing the relevance of culture and context, time and place, metaphor and mediation, whether scrutinizing the absence or perhaps noting the pernicious presence of women in existing knowledges. Obstacles had to be overcome. One feminist historian from my birthplace in Sydney reported that when a group of students asked for women's history to be included in their courses in the mid-1970s, one senior academic replied that he saw no more reason to include women than cats or dogs or canaries. Times change. Indeed, they do. And with posthumanism, not only women, but those dogs and cats may come along together with their cages and their litter, all tumbling into history today. Sneers and laughter, affirming superiority, keeping the less powerful in their place, had to shift up a gear, had to smarten up. Women not only entered the disciplines, but once visible, of course, we quickly diversified as objects of study, subjects of power and agency. Moreover, the very next move, which some academic feminists began, was to desire a type of discipline of their own, at first women's, then women and gender studies. However, like the concurrent blooming of cultural studies and soon emerging race studies, the paradoxical underpinning of these putative new disciplines, as of course we've heard today, was what what we called then their interdisciplinary nature. Furthermore, these new branches of knowledge, women and gender studies in particular, were quickly riven by all the fault lines of theorizing the instantiation of any form of human subjecthood. By the 1980s, it was clear, in ways that many feminists had partially registered from the beginning, that any notion of shared womanhood could be seen as submerging the significance of structural and discursive multitudes of intersecting power differences, most notably, of course, around class, race, ethnicity, sexuality, age, able-bodiedness, the list proliferates the longer women are there studying themselves. You know the story. Women's studies and the impact of feminism in diverse disciplines emerged just as the influence of continental philosophy and critical theory generally was about to make their object of study, our object of study, more contentious, and their epistemological epistemological framework less secure. It was soon feminist scholars themselves who were becoming more attentive to and helping to shape the impact of psychoanalytic thought in fragmenting any notion of the female subject, whether viewed individually or collectively as rational agents of their own destiny. They were also beginning to disseminate post-structuralism and more generally within the academy during the 1990s. Certainly, feminists were no longer simply reclaiming those women's voices, absent or demeaned, since some of us were now firmly setting the agenda, but rather in different ways, according to their guiding theoretical mentors, were on the one hand using Freud for theorizing the complex nature of subjectivity, the precariousness of sexual difference, and the place of unconscious fantasy in the formation of feminine selfhood and social identity. Or, rather differently, on the other hand, and again in mutating ways, they were using Foucault or Derrida, Deleuze comes only a little later, into feminist thought, somewhat differently to stress the fictive, unstable nature of any identity positions. Feminism without women was how the literary critic Tanya Modleski crossly labelled this term over 20 years ago, dedicating her book simply to the women, whose voices she feared might be effaced once more in post-structuralist theorising. Furthermore, in a related anxiety for some feminists, deconstructing differences also brought men and masculinity firmly into the picture in new ways. If you looked at your Routledge catalogues on gender, suddenly it was all about men and masculinity, and the women seemed to be disappearing. Although men's studies had already emerged, especially in the USA, as a strange, as some thought, misbegotten offspring of women's studies, alongside awareness of greater gender and sexual diversities and fluidities. After Judith Butler, quickly the iconic figure for deconstruction and all she has influenced, the cutting edge of feminist scholarship argued that no versions of femaleness or maleness are definitive, however biologically, psychologically, socially, or politically inflected, but rather the product of a complex network of meanings attaching to biology, behaviour, interpersonal, social, and institutional relations. Keeping track of all of this was hardly straightforward. Feminism had brought women and gender into the academy, all right, but quite how feminist research should now proceed in relation to women, gender, and broader political struggles was becoming a lot less clear. Thus, Joan Scott, perhaps the best-known feminist historian in the USA, recently summed up what she had learned from language and psychoanalysis over three decades. What psychoanalysis helps illuminate is the ultimate unknowability of sexual difference and the nature of the quest for knowledge of it by way of fantasy, identification, and projection. The vertigo that ensures for the historian deprives her of the certainty of her categories of analysis and leaves her searching only for the right questions to ask. Vertigo, of course, is not the best weapon for political action. However, certainty can be equally problematic for feminists, especially given the deepening divisions between women, as well as between feminist scholars and activists. Indeed, feminism was itself always in danger of becoming authoritarian and dogmatic, as indeed it has sometimes proved to be. Think Catherine MacKinnon and feminist fundamentalism. It's always in danger of that if we believe that sexual difference and gender matters are ever straightforward. Even our most basic goals, such as how best to pursue gender equality, or indeed whether that should be the pursuit, have proved controversial. Was the battle primarily against culture and male dominance, or the gendered economic realities of the market? What remains of the connection between the two? Should feminists put more effort into understanding the psychic and symbolic instabilities of sexual difference, or, like Cixous and Irigaray, and somewhat differently, Braidotti, stressed the significance of valuing the inherently dissident or unreadable qualities of the feminine? I'm not going to answer those questions, you'll be pleased to know. Not here, not now. Though I have often regretted that, at least until very recently, the glamour and excitement that can be generated by the interest in subjectivity and discursive interpolation from the 1990s partially sidelined social and economic questions, though This is another binary, of course, that need not hold, that we need to do a lot of work to bring together. Obviously, scholarship can never simply collapse into activism, and necessarily our interests and priorities shift as times change. The psychic and discursive terrain still installing hierarchical and indeed any fixed notions of gender and sexuality still need to be contested. Although, if we want to engage in the politics of the present, we must register it as one where rising inequality and precarity continue to threaten all vulnerable people in rather fixed ways. This includes the manner in which precarity's insecurities, fears of falling, of failing, are constantly diverted into bullying forms of sexism, homophobia, and rising racisms. Interpersonally, while assisting in national orchestrations of catastrophic violence in global arenas. So, scholarship, however transdisciplinary, cannot directly engender ethical or political priorities, but it can help us find, perhaps as Scott hoped, some of the right questions to ask if we want to keep a connection between our academic interests and social engagements in struggles against both the interpersonal and systemic violences of our time. This brings me to Ken's work and all the questions he keeps in mind as he goes about his clinical work with children and with adults. The problem, as he muses about masculinity and its endless mutations, is how to understand the ways in which gender is constituted through aggressive and often violent forms of social regulation. He knows a lot about how this works, from its naturalized expression, most everyday expression, boys will be boys, while noting the potential richness and joys of healthier forms of phallic narcissism, to the inner recesses of regulatory anxiety in the naming and shaming of all those seen as exhibiting failed masculinity, especially in the plethora of diagnostic discourses that coalesce around feminine and girly boys. This has become his special object of study and engagement, and it makes for riveting reading, not least because his openness to the mysteries of emerging masculinities, or indeed any other fixed identity, is coupled with an ongoing, still necessary critique of a clinical profession remaining largely blind to the violence of its own regulatory role in policing gender hierarchies. His work begins in the clinic, but it spirals out to address the normative regulation of some of the most brutal practices of our time. My first thought, however, is that it both opens and closes with considerable intellectual optimism, something we all like, but one can also ponder a little more, perhaps a little too much optimism. His paper begins, the 21st century, in the 21st century, clinical psychoanalysis surely has as much to do with feminism, queer theory, and social philosophy as it does with Freudian tenets of diverse origins. I'm not so sure that it does here in the UK. Take, for example, someone I very much admire, Juliet Mitchell, rightly hailed as one of the first to play a critical role in instigating and shaping the dialogue between contemporary feminism and psychoanalysis via her classic 70s text, Psychoanalysis and Feminism. Yet, as I've suggested before, her theoretical and professional engagement in analysis, although critical and creative, nowadays deploys notions of kinship and symbolic structures that dismiss any emphasis on historical or cultural contingency surrounding the meanings of gender and identity, for a focus on psychoanalytic explanations that by and large work to reinforce rather than to question the coercive normalizing of heterosexuality and sexual difference. That is, Mitchell uses the classic Oedipal narrative to suggest that when revisionists, like Ken, stress gender ambiguity and gender uncertainties, they forget, she says, the problem of engendering. We cannot, she goes on to insist, abandon the classic Oedipal developmental narrative because, sexuality is the process that enables one to find the gendered other as different from oneself, so that she or he can be used as other for the purposes of engendering. Little fluidity there. That's in her book on hysteria in the year 2000. Indeed, in her reading here, the hysteric remains the person who cannot find their place within a future where they are positioned differently in relation to procreation. We remain firmly within the heteronormative analysis of gender Ken is critiquing. There can be two and only two ways of conceiving gender, each defined by what the other is not. No reference here, as Ken makes in Boyhoods, his excellent book Boyhoods, to the clinical psychologist Kenneth Liu's account in 1988 of 12 possible permutations of desiring positions for the child within Oedipal theory, nor a decade later for the exuberant Leo Bassani's 10 possible desiring positions. I'm surprised he didn't try and outdo Liu's, but he has 10, within the Oedipal triad, in which the identity and the sex of the agents are irrelevant. The identity and the sex of the agents are irrelevant. So, as I say, how about transdisciplinary and critical, as Mitchell certainly is, and however feminist and Lacanian informed, I think clinical psychoanalysis in the UK remains more constrained than some of their New York variants in its thoughts on gender, especially on engendering masculinities. Ken is in accord with some of the most innovative writings of his fellow New York clinicians with whom he works, Virginia Goldner, Muriel Dimon, Adrienne Harris, who reject the one-off identification and disidentification of the normative Oedipal narrative, with mothers and fathers always fixed in place, for a far looser, unfolding process in which sexed identity is never internalized as a single entity, positively or negatively, but rather operates subjectively within an array of always more ambiguous, always more conflictual mental representations and self-perceptions, sedimented out of the unique identifications each child makes with its very own parents, siblings, and significant others. However much these interactions are always, of course, already permeated with the polarizing effects of culture, with its symbolic phallocentrism and still prevailing, though increasingly diverse and disputed, social and familial patterns of male dominance. In the UK, those most attuned to the paradoxes of gender often cite the work of the French psychoanalyst Jean Laplanche, who died 2 weeks ago on the day of the French election, which was very sad. And of course, you refer to Laplanche in your talk, who argues that the unconscious of the child is not so much the effect of the child's identifications with its opposed parents, as from the outside, the implantation of an always unique bundle of enigmatic signifiers or untranslatable messages coming from the unconscious desires of the mother or other significant adults via what Laplanche terms seduction. All this fits Ken's rejection of traditional Freudian thought and his desire for a new Freud, a Freud who can work in tandem with Foucault, and his rejection of the idea that like simply produces like, where it is therefore only identification with men and fathers that produces masculinity, and only identification with women and mothers that produces femininity. So it's only identification with men and fathers that produces the masculinity of boys and with mothers of girls. Meanwhile, mothers are additionally always guilty, as ever, for those girly boys, whether accused of too much, too little, too ambivalent, too whatever a concern with sons. Anyway, always to blame for their aberrant sons, their aberrant children, actually to blame for social ills more generally. And Ken gives examples of the way in which, in his clinical studies, it was not aberrant mothers in particular who seemed to be to blame for whatever the sufferings of the difficulties their sons had in lining up with normative masculinity. In line with these positions, what is so continuously evident in Ken's work is its delightful intricacy in pondering the incessant, irresolvable dilemmas of becoming a grown-up, becoming a big boy, revealing in the process that psychoanalysis and popular culture more generally chooses to downplay the complexity that is masculinity. Yes, phallic fantasies of dominance, authority, impregnability remain ubiquitous in the masculine archetype. Yet no one male, no one boy ever exactly fits, ever one generalization, as he struggles to embody or distance himself from the blueprint of masculinity, which Ken rightly sees as resting largely on its phobic defenses against what is seen as dependency, weakness, femininity. Ken's writing also closes optimistically. Seemed to close a little less optimistically today than when I read it the first time round, with boys like Lincoln more able to imagine their way into a space where gender is more malleable and the narratives of masculinity more open and fluid. Reality bends, he says, in Boyhoods and the paper. Transformations of the social symbolic order are occurring today because of the widening frame of marriage laws, the changing definitions of the family, the shift in gender roles, all of which lessen the impact of traditional understandings of gender. Gender codes multiply and enrich the language web for discussing the complexities of gender. All true and very significant. But, and yet, it is also true, I fear, that as old fixities loosen, new anxieties, especially around masculinity, are being anxiously reinforced. Thus, if we look around us to survey who is likely to be most fluid and metrosexual, and who is likely to go queer bashing or setting alight to abortion in clinics, or God forbid, admiring the mass murder in Norway, Breivik, or murdering transsexual boys, as happened in the adopted mixed race, vulnerable and volatile Larry King that Ken also writes about so well, we see other dynamics of power brutally interacting with gender. As Ken also says, gender identities are routinely and soundly trumped by narratives of race, class, historical epoch, and social location. Perhaps they're not so much trumped as always permeated by the privileges or the injuries of those particular identifications interacting with gender, class, race, nation, and so on. 25 years ago, I began writing my own book on men and masculinity, Slow Motion, Changing Masculinities, Changing Men, another optimistic book, which I had to draw back from some of the optimism when it was reissued a few years ago. I've passed through many lives since then and was barely aware of Derrida or deconstruction at the time. However, like Ken, I was aware and endlessly puzzling over the impossibility of grounding men or masculinity in any one thing, seeing their colours as changing across time and place. But noting that one feature survived, its position of symbolic dominance alongside the rise and fall of attempts to shore up the legitimacy of men's increasingly contested power and privileges in shifting conjunctures. Is masculinity a transdisciplinary concept? On course, yeah. The answer certainly is yes. It has to be. It has to be because any attempt to hold up that key ingredient of masculinity as in some way pertaining to the situation of becoming a man, of embracing the mantle of manhood, is inevitably tied to politics, taking us back to all those disciplines that I rolled out at the beginning. It is tied to a structure of power, which both queer theorists and clinicians can observe whenever they look for it. But the linguistic mobility and fluid performativity, perhaps engendered by unpacking the conceptual dependencies of manhood on all it hopes to submerge, passivity, femininity, fragility, do not in themselves, sadly, undo individual, social and cultural investments in masculinity's old entitlements. For it is politically, economically and militarily that a symbolically authoritative manhood, powerful manhood, is maintained. This obdurate resilience in patterns of gender hierarchy thus partially mocks any welcoming of the growing diversity in men's lives when, for instance, any gender equality on the home front is confronted by refurbished militaristic manhoods in the global arena. There are just two things to say here, my last two points. The first is to keep on emphasizing, as Ken's work does, that it is just such images of impregnable manhood that are responsible for the ways in which men and boys suffer often hideously, primarily at the hands of their fellow men and boys. And secondly, since we know psychic and cultural fantasy is not separable from the ways in which material life is organized, growing awareness of the contradictory and contested nature of masculinity will not result in genuine acceptance of its fluidities until women everywhere are no longer positioned as the subordinate sex. A transdisciplinary project, a political project, a daunting project for sure.